Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. My name is Ben Galler. I'm with BlazersEdge.com, and I'm here with Nate McMillan's number one defender, a man in mourning, head to toe in either Sonics green and yellow or black. I'm not sure what it is today. Kevin Pelton, you're here to take your lumps. I apologize, but you're going to have to really own up to a lot of comments you made on our last episode. Got a lot of explaining to do. I'm going to rub a lot of salt into your wounds. It's going to be great. How excited are you right now?
Would you say this is a very special episode of the D'Antonio Wingcast?
I would say this is probably the greatest episode ever. We're only 30 seconds in. This is going to be so good. So let's recap what happened on the last episode. When did we talk? About what, 3-4 weeks ago?
Yeah, sometime about a month ago.
Okay, and the Blazers were starting to teeter. Season was kind of maybe going a couple different directions, and basically lay out your arguments at that time about the status of Coach Nate McMillan, who was in his seventh season here in Portland, and also, you know, your impressions of maybe his relationship with Raymond Felton and how that might look going forward.
I don't know if I commented specifically on his relationship with Ray. I mean, I think my general perspective at that point was, let's all remain calm and not panic. And, you know, that with Nate, that I don't think that whatever you do, you're going to find a better coach than him, I think was probably my general sentiment.
No, let's be honest. You said the Blazers should not fire him. He should have been coach of the year, number one coach in the NBA. He got snubbed the last couple of years when he didn't win the award. You're going to name your firstborn child after him. And Raymond Felton was going to turn it all around because you trusted the numbers, because he had done so well in his previous career, and this was such an outlier. He was going to completely transform his career in the second half of the season and get back to normal, and the Blazers were going to go for a strong playoff push. That was basically your argument. Let's be honest here.
I think the second half is more accurate than the first half there.
Okay, well, what did I get wrong? Explain it.
Well, I don't recall saying anything about Nate being coach of the year.
Oh, come on. Now you're just backtracking. You are Nate McMillan's number one defender, right? I got the right Kevin Pelton here on the phone. I didn't call somebody by accident.
I mean, the thing is, you could go in the entire city of Seattle and everyone would have the same opinion as I do. This is not, like, something that's unique to me.
Okay, so it's like it's a citywide delusion. Is that the issue, or what was the problem? Why everybody? Just because of how much he means to you guys up there, or what?
No, because we saw him leave and be replaced by Bob Weiss and Bob Hill and P.J. Carlesimo.
Okay, so the memories of that horrible post-McMillan era still haunt you to this day.
It'll be fair to say.
Okay, well, now we have a little better idea where you actually stood. So when we last ended the podcast, I said I'd call you back in a week once Nate was fired. You started cracking up laughing. Well, I called you back a month later. Nate's been fired. It happened on Thursday, less than an hour after the deadline it was announced. The Blazers shipped out two starters, Marcus Camby and Gerald Wallace. They're obviously headed for a rebuild. What's your general reaction? Did Nate need to go here? Are you willing to finally admit that?
He had obviously lost to that locker room. I think that the question you have to ask is, you know, the general cliche is, well, you can't fire the players, you fire the coach, but the Blazers, in this case, probably could have fired all the players and fired about half of them. If they had bought out Raymond Felton, you know, you're talking about getting down to just Jamal Crawford of the guys who, you know, were the players who, in particular, Nate was not reaching. So, I mean, I think your question here is less to be about going backwards, where obviously there something needed to dramatically change, and more about going forward, who is the best coach for a team that's obviously rebuilding and trying to develop young talent. So, I mean, I think that's where you have to answer the question. That's the kind of the framework.
See, that was a really tricky move you just tried to pull. You tried to get me to bite on the whole buyout Raymond Felton thing because, you know, I'll rant for 10 minutes about that and get off your back about how much you love Nate, but I'm not going to fall for that trick, Kevin. I know all your tricks. I know all your debating strategies. So, did Nate McMillan bear responsibility for everybody quitting on him? Can you hold him accountable for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a coach. That's his job.
And what did he do wrong? Where was his error?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know that we can answer that because we're not in that locker room. But the results the last three or four games speak for themselves. I don't know that I've ever seen an NBA team play with less pride than the Blazers showed in those games.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing the words that the management level was using. You know, frustrating, disappointing, not Blazer basketball. They didn't say it. I don't think they said at any point that they quit, but they were clearly, you know, completely taken aback by the effort level, especially on the road trip. And I guess this brings us back to the Felton question, which is he a coach killer? Are you ready to call him that?
I would say that the problems in Portland go beyond Raymond Felton, but I mean, yes.
Wow. You said it. I didn't think you were going to say it. You're so nice, Kevin. Okay, what is it about him that makes him a coach killer? Elaborate.
Well, his complete inability to make a shot this year obviously didn't help. I mean, you know, I think the question that I will wonder forever going forward is if you could rerun this season with Felton playing at the level I think we all expected of him. I don't think that my expectations coming into the season were out of line from everyone else's. And winning a couple of those close games early and things like that. And, you know, there wasn't the same level of frustration that I think developed. And I think that ultimately is what turned into the team quitting on Nate. You know, if they win a few more of those early games and they're in second place in the West, then, you know, I think you guys can set aside some of their disappointment with their own role a little bit easier than they could in the way it actually played out.
I think that's a great point. I mean, there's definitely a snowball effect to this, and I think what we're seeing is one of those Pritchardisms about how, you know, winning is contagious and losing is contagious. Would you kind of, you know, get the sense it almost like swept the locker room like a plague after a few of those, you know, disappointing early losses? You know, they start to lose faith in what they can do down the stretch. They don't ever really have a go-to player. You know, Felton's shot is so shaky that, you know, really everyone loses confidence in him very early. His minutes start to get cut. You know, teammates start to look at him a different way. He obviously starts to shoot the ball a different way, and, you know, he admits going through all these, you know, almost like a crisis of confidence in terms of his shot. And then he starts taking it on Nate McMillan. I mean, is that what this was, a matter of they didn't have enough structure and aligned goals so that the losing, you know, basically became like a disease and basically overwhelmed everyone, even people who may, under normal circumstances, you know, have winning personalities?
I think that's a fair assessment. You know, and I think it's a lesson from my perspective in terms of some of these trends we saw early in the season. They may have been likely, to even out, but the way that things transpired, you know, these are humans, and it affected them in a way that, you know, they can't be as rational and big picture perspective is bound to get better. You know, they just see what they're going through on a day-to-day basis and the level of frustration that built up there. I mean, I guess if it was a disappointment for me, it's that it seemed like the Blazers had enough strong veteran leaders in the locker room that this shouldn't have happened. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, you know, they have a lot of guys who are sort of borderline, and you can do the glasses half empty approach, you can do the glasses half full approach. You know, a guy like Marcus Camby may be the perfect example. When he comes to Portland, this team is making a serious playoff push, and he is locked in, maxed out, trying to get his new contract. I think that was part of it. But also trying to make a really good first impression, and also feeling like a team led by Brandon Roy could do some serious damage in the playoffs. He wants to win. He's been to that big stage before in the finals. He knows what that's about. At his age, you know, that's what he's playing for. He's not playing for a 500 or slightly below 500 team. He's not going to go out there and kill himself against, you know, seven opponents in seven or in 10 days on a road trip or whatever the road trip was, 12 days. And in fact, he's not going to kill himself. He's going to go out there and try to kill other people so he actually doesn't have to play through it because he's so sick of it. He's going to try to kill Landry Fields. He's going to try to kill Kevin Serafin. So you can go both ways on some of these guys. Gerald Wallace is another good example. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, his teams haven't advanced in the playoffs too. I think he's got a little bit of the Andre Miller thing where, you know, he's very, very good at what he does. He's not as consistent, obviously, as Miller, but the package that he brings, unless it's the absolute right fit with the key pieces around him, it's not necessarily a package that's going to be able to deliver postseason success just because of the nature of his game. And it's something that you see him as a supporting piece last year during sort of an exciting run or a positive momentum push. You can see him as a major anchor this year on what they're trying to do because, you know, people don't know what they can get out of him from night-to-night basis. And, you know, he struggled so much with his shots. His concentration just didn't seem like it was there. I mean, all these things are issues that can, you know, kind of pull you back down. And then another big question mark right now, and I've been kind of writing this and hitting this, but LaMarcus Aldridge, I mean, he has not shown up since the All-Star break in any meaningful fashion. I don't want to say that he's checked out, but his personality is very, very different, especially if we go back and compare it to his amazing stretch run, not this season, but the previous season, where he basically put the entire team on his back. I mean, his personality is totally fed off what he does on the court. If he goes out and has 30 and 12, he's going to be, you know, so locked in and engaged and willing to talk. You know, after these games, when they're getting killed, you know, they're running out of excuses. I mean, he's basically just checking out of the interviews, really bland comments, repeating the same things game after game after game. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not good enough from your leadership perspective. But I think he also, sort of like McMillan, came to terms with the fact that this team wasn't as talented as they thought it was. And because he had set such high expectations earlier in the season, I think there was a big disappointment factor there. And that's hard to overcome if you've got all these other, you know, factors, you know, sort of negatively weighing down the team's success. So, I mean, I think that, you know, it's definitely salvageable if you can excise the right pieces. And I think that moving Wallace and Camby were both smart. I think they should have been trying to move Felton absolutely no matter what. The buyout idea makes a lot of sense. Do you think there's some potential, though, they could do a sign-and-trade or something this summer and try to get something back out of him? I mean, do you think that maybe that's why he stuck around? Like, they feel like even though he's played so terribly, like potentially there's some future payoff and an asset there, because there's no way he's going to be back on the roster next season. But do you think that might be one factor influencing why he hasn't been dumped?
I think that might be a factor. If your question is whether I think that there's a chance that that happened, my answer is no, based on, you know, both some of the limits on sign and trades in the new CBA and the fact that Felton wasn't, you know, a guy whose value was far above the mid-level exception before this. So I don't see how, you know, he'd command that kind of money or really be that valuable in a trade. I mean, to me, there's no argument against buying him out. And as you know, I'm Felton's biggest defender, so.
Well, how about this? Is this the argument? Is this the real argument for not buying him out? Is that they're afraid to admit how bad that trade was? Because, you know, Larry Miller told me point blank, he's like, he still defended the trade as of 2-3 weeks ago, even though they traded Miller, Fernandez, a pick, the rights to Kopitin, all for Felton, a backup point guard who's played like a below average backup point guard. They still defend that trade up through, you know, 2-3 weeks ago in that long interview I did with him. Do you think that the real only reason they haven't bought him out or they're not considering buying him out is because they're afraid to admit that mistake?
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, just running him out there on a nightly basis, it's not like you're covering it up by doing that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's really weird to me. I don't understand why they're letting him sort of fester and hang around. And even the comment, oh, he'll play hard for us the next 22 games. Well, he probably will now that he killed Nate. But, you know, and he's got to realize that his next paycheck is, you know, on the brink at this point. But I don't know, man. I feel like that would have been the move to do. Getting Flynn back, I mean, I guess he can't really play. The problem is they don't have anyone else to play one, and we saw what happens when Jamal plays one. So maybe they feel like they're still stuck with him, just like Nate felt like he was stuck with having to start him too. But anyway, let's get back to Nate for a sec. Your reflections on the Nate McMillan era, don't you think it's a little bit symbolic? He goes down on the same day Odin goes down.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely some symbolism there. I think one of the questions that Beckley asked me yesterday when I went on HoopSpeak right after the deadline was about kind of what was the moment this all turned, and he pointed to the day Roy retired, and I don't know, I feel like you almost can trace it back further than that. But then, you know, the combination of that and Odin finding out that he probably wasn't going to play this year. Yeah, I mean, to have it all end yesterday, I think, was very fitting.
I think the day that it all turned was the Microfracture announcement, not this current one this season, but the previous one, when Jay Jensen was out there giving the full rundown of how Greg had suffered the injury during that pregame workout. You know, he was very, very, very sad, very depressed, and very detailed, basically laying out every last aspect of what had happened. And that really felt like, you know, when you're sitting there during that press conference, it felt like these guys realize something cannot be undone has just happened. You know, there's no turning back from this. They all feel horrible about it. Rich Cho at the time didn't even want to talk about it or say anything during the press conference. Larry was very down at that point. To me, that was a turning point of this era because it was the moment that the hope was extinguished, right? I mean, after that, it went from sort of realistic hope or potential hope to sort of desperation hope. And there's a big difference, and I think desperation hope, often turns out to kind of work out in a bad way. And that's sort of where they're at right now, is they're kind of dealing with the repercussions of, taking some really long odds and some chances on Oden, well after the fact rather than moving on earlier.
Well, I mean, from their perspective, the cost was so low, and I think what we found out ultimately was the biggest cost of keeping Odin around in terms of seeing whether his rehabilitation might bear something was having that roster spot. So, the cost
No,
of
but
I'm on.
it's the mental cost, though, KP. It's just the idea of, oh, we're still hanging on to this guy. We're still going to allow him to sort of hover over the franchise. We're still going to be talking about him as a guy maybe we can pair with Aldridge. We're still going to say, okay, LA, you're going to have this Twin Towers, and he's doing all of his All-Star interviews talking about how he wanted to be like David Robinson and Tim Duncan. It's that mental standpoint, the crutch of saying, oh, maybe he's going to come back, maybe he's going to be able to fix this, that kind of paralyzes the team, And they want to do the same thing with Brandon Roy, and that's ultimately, with the amnesty decision, that was an important step as well. I kind of agree with Beckley's point. That was an important, flip situation there because you really did have to, be forced to deal with the new reality. But still, with Oden hanging, even though, his contribution wasn't going to be major or whatever, it's more symbolic, It's like Nate could never escape the shadow that those two guys cast.
But I feel like, the early in the season they were escaping that shadow, the way they started the year, and
Fool's gold.
they were beating
Ahead.
good teams. I mean, they were then beating the heck out of bad teams. I mean, that what we saw from them the first month of the season was a good team, which is what makes this all the more bizarre.
So, yeah, let's talk about that. You said it's bizarre. So, Chad Buchanan and these guys, I mean, they basically said they were really disappointed, and they said they didn't really know why everybody checked out on Nate. And they had obviously, had a pretty strong start, especially at home, and, they racked up some really big blowout victories over bad teams. How do you explain it? What do the numbers say? Or is this a situation where you just can't use numbers to explain this mess?
Well, the one thing I pointed out a couple weeks ago in a column I did was, what we know from the history is that a team, it would be unprecedented for them to continue to have such a big gap between their point differential and their win percentage as the Blazers had in the early in the season. Now, what that doesn't guarantee is that when it evens up, it's going to be the win percentage that's going to be going up as opposed to the point differential going down, which is what we've actually seen. But no, I mean, they're two totally different teams that bear nothing in relationship with each other. The team that we saw the first, 20 or 24 games, I think what Oklahoma City was game 24, and then the team that we've seen the 24 games or so since then. Those are just they you can't even you wouldn't even be able to tell that they were the same group of players and coach unless you knew that they were.
So let's highlight on Felton. You said he was going to have a bounce back because you trusted his statistical body of work. Has any of that happened, or are you ready to admit that I was right?
None of that has happened in practice, no.
Wait. I didn't hear that. You were right? I think that's what you're trying to say?
You were correct. I mean, I still stand by the larger sample size is what you have to go with to analyze these situations. But in this case, it's gone far enough that it's pretty clear that it's becoming more like a Travis Outlaw situation last year where, his numbers in New Jersey were way out of line with the rest of his career. So you expect him to bounce back at least a little bit, but in Sacramento, he's been no better.
Okay, I want to hear this last thing out of your mouth, then we're going to have to wrap this up. I want to hear you say, if you were Chad Buchanan yesterday, you would have fired Nate McMillan too.
I don't know that I necessarily would fire Nate McMillan because, like I said, if you get rid
Oh,
of all the
no.
players, then it doesn't matter. But I mean, the question is he the best coach for a rebuilding team? He did a pretty good job last time, but that's probably not. I don't think you would say that. I don't think any of us would say is the strength of his coaching style. And the one thing is, I see a lot of people thinking how sad they are for Nate, and based on the comments in the press conference, it didn't sound like he certainly wanted this or even necessarily expected it. But he's going to get another job, and he doesn't have to sit through the last month and a half of this season, which is going to be ugly. So I don't think this is the worst thing in the world that's happened to Nate.
No, I totally agree with all that. Well, so here's my question. Does it feel like this was a worse job, a worse decision because they fired him and kept Felton? Like if they had done both, if they had traded Felton for peanuts and got rid of McMillan, would there be less of a bad taste, or would it be like a totally like co-sign move from your standpoint? Because you'd be like, okay, everything wasn't working, it's done. But because they kept Felton, does that kind of take the luster off and make you question the decision just a little bit?
I mean, it makes it look a little bit like they chose Felton over Nate. They chose the Mutineers. But
I
I
know,
don't
and
think that's
that's
really what they were
horrible,
doing.
right?
Yeah.
Isn't that a bad implication?
If you are a point guard who shoots 30% from the field and you rise up against your coach, you're going to be the one who wins in that situation.
All right. Well, anything else to add about Nate? I mean, I know you really are his defender. I've been going at you pretty hard on this podcast, but I also gave you a lot of rope to hang yourself on the last one. And I understand the depth of your loyalty to him. When you look back in 5 years on Nate as the Blazers coach, personally, when I look back at 5 years, I think I'm going to have really enjoyed the era despite his eccentricities. You always knew what you were going to get from him. You were always going to get professionalism in terms of his conduct and his interactions with the media. And you can't say that about every coach in the NBA. You can't say that about every person in the NBA. And you can certainly say that about him, and I think that's one reason why he didn't maybe get it as hard in these last couple of months, and maybe as he should have. I think a lot of people had a lot of respect for him, and they didn't necessarily want to start, pushing that argument, in public. There's a few exceptions, obviously. I think we know who has been calling for Nate's head regularly, Dwight James. But for the most part, I think he got a lot of respect, and I think he earned it just based on his conduct. So how will you look back on Nate in 5 years as the Blazers coach?
I mean, I feel like he steered this organization through a difficult time. I mean, it's easy to see how hard things are right now and how down this year is ending, but still nothing can get as bad as the situation was in 2004-05 when you had a team that was both underperforming and, problematic off the court. The organization as a whole was just, I don't know, secretive and there was a standoffish relationship with the local media. So, I mean, I think to go from that to what you had for a couple of years there is a pretty enormous transformation.
Oh, yeah, last thing. Did it bother you what Larry Miller said to me? I think Nate lost some of the players. He lost the ability to motivate the players and to go out and give 100%. Then later he said, "We lost by 40 points to Knicks. What more do I need to say?" Is that a way to kind of kiss off a guy who's worked for you for 6.5 years?
No, I don't think about it because I mean those are facts, and if you're asking like, why do you object to doing this? Like, what is there to salvage at this point?
All
So it's
right, so
just a question of.
you're not gonna get on Larry for going after your guy. I thought you might take that a little personally. I mean, he was like, you would admit he was pretty candid about the things that he said yesterday, right?
Yeah, definitely. I he wasn't really quite willing to call it a rebuild in his conversation with you, but he was willing to let you call it a rebuild.
Yeah, I like that. What a compromise. Well, I will call it a rebuild. Thanks, Larry.
Don't
But
call it a
yeah.
rebuild. We've been here for years.
Don't call it a comeback either. All right, we should probably end on that note, KP. Wait, did we get what you were going to think about Nate for 5 years, or did I screw that up?
I don't know. I think generally, I mean, I just, this was this has been a strange time for me, obviously, personally. So to have Nate down here and kind of a beacon of the past was always enjoyable for me. And I think he did a fine job molding this team into a competitive team, which can be difficult to do. I mean, most teams don't do what the Blazers did in terms of getting from being a 20-win team to 50-win team as quickly as they did, and I think that's still an accomplishment, even if it didn't turn out the way everyone hoped it would.
Very good. All right, KP. It was nice to hear you say I was right for the first time in the D'Antonio Wincast history. Actually, didn't you admit that LeBron was a choker at some point and he was garbage and he wasn't nearly as good as you thought he was after the finals, maybe? Or did I just make that up?
I think you probably exaggerated. I can't imagine that I would have used the term choker since I hate that word so
Yeah, sure you do.
vehemently.
Well, you numbers guys, you get so far down the wormhole, you can't tell when bad play comes out, and the Felton's LeBrons of the world, they just blind you with their numbers. I understand how it is. Their sample size and all that other stuff, you just get so lost. But, hey, by the way, congratulations to the Indiana Pacers. You guys are having a hell of a season.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You have any coach killers on your roster? All right. Talk to you later, KP.
All right, always enjoyable to do a Wincast.
Killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.